Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. It's the radio show and podcast that aims to get you thinking every Saturday on Premier Christian Radio and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. I'm usually joined by Christians and non-Christians to discuss aspects of faith and belief from various different perspectives. And today is no exception. A little bit different, though, to the radio version of the show today. This is the full recording of an event that took place in Cambridge last week that I was invited to chair. I'll be giving you the full description of what's coming up on the programme today and who's involved in a moment's time. If you're new to the programme, then can I encourage you to check out the website of Unbelievable at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. There you'll be able to find links to the DVD of last year's Apologetics Conference, Unbelievable the Conference 2012, which featured speakers like John Lennox, Hugh Ross and Ken Samples of Reasons to Believe in the US, Krish Kandaya from the Evangelical Alliance here in the UK, Bonnie Yule Kuhn and other contributors. And it's over 10 hours across 3 DVDs, loads of material, yours for just £20 if you want to go to the website premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Click on the link there for the DVD. And just a date for your diary, and hopefully we're going to get the booking options online very soon indeed for this year's Unbelievable Conference here in London. We're going to be having Alistair McGrath join us, who's well known around the world as a Christian thinker, theologian, former scientist himself. He's one of our keynote speakers alongside another great apologist, Amy Orr Ewing from the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. We'll also be hearing from Fuz Rana of Reasons to Believe, comes over from the States to join us for that. We'll also have Peter S. Williams, who's a Christian philosopher, at the conference, alongside Trevor Stammers of the Christian Medical Fellowship, as we tackle some ethical issues as well at this year's conference. So full details being released next week on the podcast, we hope, of what's coming up at this year's conference. The date to save, if you're wanting to come along to it, is Saturday the 25th of May. Make sure you get that ring-fenced in your diary, circled so that you don't book anything else in, and you know that you're going to be free for what promises to be another great conference, looking at the evidence for the Christian faith and engaging in a creative, fruitful way with the world around us that's asking so many questions. Well, questions were very much at the forefront of the discussion that I chaired in Cambridge last week, and that's the subject of today's show. Let me tell you what's coming up today.
You're unbelievable.
I was invited by the Veritas Forum in Cambridge to chair a discussion between Christian philosopher Keith Ward and atheist philosopher Arif Ahmed. It was titled simply, Unbelievable? A Christian and atheist philosopher discuss their worldviews. Well, if you want to find out more about Veritas, do check out their website, veritas.org. You can also find the European version at veritasforum.eu. What we'll hear today is simply the event as it happened. Both philosophers gave their presentations for their worldview, then they sat down with me to draw out that discussion a bit further, and then we took some questions from the audience. And it was great to see the lecture theatre absolutely packed full of students, professors, academics and others who had come out for this debate organised by Veritas. So that's what you can look forward to on the programme today. We're going to be saving the feedback from the last few weeks of programming till next week's programme. Some really interesting responses to the Atheist Church show of last week. Hang on for that for next week if you download this programme. And next week you can also expect to hear a fabulous guest joining me on the show, N.T. Wright, Tom Wright, one of the leading New Testament historians and scholars in the world. We're going to be tackling one of the big issues that he's so well known for, the new perspective on Paul and justification. He's going to be interacting with another Bible scholar who doesn't agree with him on his take on justification, salvation and all those kinds of issues. So if you want to hear that, tune in same time next week, either on Premier Christian Radio at 2:30 p.m. on Saturday or via the podcast here at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. For the moment, though, let's get on with the event that we're hearing today, which was this event put on by the Veritas Forum in Cambridge. And what we're going to be hearing, first of all, is one of the organisers of the event, James Orr, who's been on this programme before, and he introduces the event and the speakers.
Wonderful turnout this evening. Thank you so much indeed for coming and braving the cold and the icy Cambridge winter. It's a great delight to welcome you all here tonight to this, the first Veritas event of 2013. A brief word about Veritas. It's an organisation that exists to promote reasoned dialogue between followers, primarily, well, followers of the Christian faith and followers of other faiths or of no faith at all. It's organized in its history many wonderful exchanges on the God debate and on topics of interest to those on both sides of that debate. And if you'd like to listen or watch some of those, I urge you to have a look at the excellent resources section on its website at veritas.org. As many of you will be aware, there's been especially little evidence of reasoned dialogue in the public arena on these issues in recent years. A great deal of rhetorical heat, of course, but not much in the way of crisp philosophical light. So the need for that kind of dialogue is more urgent now than it ever has been before. And that's why we're so fortunate to have with us tonight such a gifted exponent of Christianity's worldview and such a gifted critic of that worldview. Our gifted exponent is Professor Keith Ward. Professor Ward has held lectureships in logic at Glasgow, in philosophy at St. Andrews, in philosophy of religion at King's College London. He was fellow dean and director of studies here in Cambridge at Trinity Hall before taking up a professorship at the University of London. Professor Ward is an ordained priest in the Church of England, a fellow of the British Academy, and a member of the Governing Council of the Royal Institute of Philosophy. And he held the Regius Professorship of Divinity at Oxford before becoming Gresham Professor of Divinity between 2004 and 2008. He's the author of many popular and academic books, including influential studies of Kant's development of ethics, divine action, religious pluralism, and more recently he's produced an excellent critique of materialism in More Than Matter, a critique of biblical literalism in The Word of God, The Bible After Modern Scholarship, and more recently a philosophical analysis of the teachings of Jesus in The Philosopher and the Gospels. Our gifted critic is Dr. Arif Ahmed, senior lecturer in the Faculty of Philosophy here in Cambridge, and an astonishingly active lecturer at that. On my reckoning, he delivers around 46 lectures in the course of the average academic year, not to mention the numerous classes and supervisions and seminars he holds in addition to that. From a background in mathematics at St. Anne's College, Oxford, Dr. Ahmed moved on to Cambridge to conduct doctoral research on the nature of necessity. He's also found time amidst all that lecturing to produce one of the finest English language introductions to the forbidding works of the American philosopher Saul Kripke, and as well as an illuminating guide to a still more challenging work, Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations. And he's written many important and influential scholarly articles on causation and modality and linguistic reference and decision theory. Dr. Ahmed is involved in the trades union movement here in the UK, is an aficionado of Baroque key music and, if I'm not mistaken, Thai kickboxing. I'm quite confident that he will not need to be demonstrating that for us tonight. We're fortunate, too, to have Justin Brierley as our chairman, Justin hosts an extremely popular weekly radio program and podcast that shares its title with this evening's event, Unbelievable, on Premier Christian Radio. And you can find a lot of those, the back catalogue of those podcasts on iTunes. We're very grateful to you, Justin, for devoting one of those programs to this evening's discussion. So without further ado, I turn to Justin to open tonight's discussions.
Well, thank you very much for coming this evening. It's great to see such a great turnout for tonight's discussion. Just to give you a little heads up on the format of tonight, we're going to be starting off with a presentation from both our guests here, firstly Keith and then Arif, as to what their worldview is. And they'll then join me for a sit-down discussion on that for a little while. And that'll be followed by a chance for your questions. So do be thinking as they're presenting and as we're speaking together, what questions you would like to ask. There'll be a chance for that later on in the evening. There'll be a roving mic going around, and I'll explain how we'll do those questions a little bit later on. For the moment, I think we'll crack on with things. And so presenting his worldview, first of all, we're going to be hearing from Keith Ward. Keith, will you take the stage and give him a round of applause as he comes there?
Thank you. Well, my worldview in 20 minutes. I'll start by saying that the world of philosophy, of course, is a world of disagreement. And it's quite wrong to think that reasonable people will all agree about anything at all. And the more reasonable you are, the more you will disagree with everybody else. And I say that as a result of a lifetime of trying to talk to philosophers. And so we're not looking at agreement in the world of philosophy. We're looking for trying to get a coherent and adequate and fruitful view of the world from the place where you start from and how you need to adjust that in the light of new knowledge that you come across. So where do I start from? Well, I'm an idealist, a personal idealist, but you may not know what that is. So let me just give a slight characterization of it. Many philosophers don't have a worldview. They don't think in such grand terms. You wouldn't necessarily have to have a whole grand narrative of the world to be a philosopher. You don't have to at all. But nevertheless, there are some very deep disputes in philosophy, and one of the deepest is the dispute between materialism and idealism. And it's these two extremes, and slight stereotypes put in that form, which I'm concerned with. And materialism would, I'll start with a rather crude definition, but the view that everything that exists is material. There is nothing that exists that is not material. So God, if God is not material, doesn't exist, probably couldn't exist. And it may be a necessary truth that everything that exists has to exist in some material form. Now, that's a crude definition, but you can see the point. The point would be that mind and thought and consciousness and things associated with that would be at best emergent features of matter, but they might actually be reducible to material things, so that mental states would be reducible to brain states. So a very hardline reductionist in materialism would say there aren't any personal experiences, there aren't any thoughts. My own teacher here at Oxford, Gilbert Ryle, used to say there are no mental images. I used to sit there having mental images in front of him. And he said, you can't be because there aren't any. And, well, that's a philosophical debate of one sort. But for a materialist, you would say there could be no mental thoughts in the sense that the accurate way to describe them is some firing of neurons in the brain, and that's the most accurate way. That's a very hard line. I think probably most materialists would be people who say, well, there may be mental thoughts and experiences and feelings, but they depend upon and they are caused by material brain states, and so they don't have any independent causal efficacy of their own. So that's materialism. But the big opposite metaphysical camp to this is idealism. And idealists think the opposite. They turn the whole thing upside down and say, actually, matter is a product of mind, that mind is the true reality, that the thing we are most clearly and firstly aware of is our own consciousness and its contents. And it's only as we grow from being little babies that we begin to say that there are objects apart from us in a physical world, and that there are other people and other minds with whom we converse. But little babies perhaps start in a world where these conceptual distinctions are not made, but there are experiences. Babies do have experiences, and I think before they have thoughts, but that's another philosophically disputable topic. So an idealist would say, well, in some sense, the mind is the thing you start from, and you can't get away from it. Now, I was brought up in my philosophical training to be an empiricist, and an empiricist is a person who says, we all start in our knowing from experience. That's where you start. All knowledge begins with experience. Now, I still believe that. And I therefore incline to think that experience cannot be eliminated. So I could never be a reductionist materialist. I could never say there aren't any experiences. They used to be called sense data in the old days. Sounds and sights and colours and feelings and thoughts. All of the contents of your consciousness, which perhaps other people never know about in the same way that you know about them. I think they are features of reality. They are features of the world. Consciousness is often thought of or described as the hard problem in physics. But actually, for an idealist philosopher like me, it's not a hard problem at all, because consciousness is what you are most immediately aware of. The problem is there anything else? And that's the problem of how, David Hume's problem, how you can say that there is actually an objective world at all. Now, that may sound a bit strange, though then philosophy does very often, but you're not really querying the existence of an objective world. You're saying, is the world as it exists objectively the same as it is when it appears to me in my consciousness? Is my consciousness of the world different from the world as it really is? And here again, I would think, well, modern physics appears to say it's very, very different, and the objective reality might consist of an 11-dimensional reality of wave functions and not at all consist of solid, coloured, three-dimensional objects. So the way it might be to a quantum physicist would be very different from the way it appears to me in the common-sense world. And that gives rise to a real problem. All quantum physicists, if they think about philosophy, have this problem, which is reality. Is it the wave functions in some multidimensional space, or is it the world of common sense? And you can go either way on this. Philosophy consists of always making these decisions about which way you're going to go. And I would just say that as a philosopher, my decision would be to go with the reality of consciousness and say, well, actually, consciousness is real. I'm not sure whether 11-dimensional realities are real, but at least talk of that sort of thing makes me certain that the way I am conscious of the world, that is, the world as it appears to my consciousness, is very different from the world as it is when I'm not being conscious of it. Now, this doesn't get you right to idealism, but it gets you to saying, perhaps, that consciousness is a real factor of the world. It cannot be eliminated. And then you ask the question, well, what's the relation between consciousness and the physical world? There is a physical world. I'm not doubting that for a moment. But it's very different from anything we see or hear or touch. It's more of a conceptual construction. We hope it's an actual one, but it's very different from anything that intuition or your feelings might tell you that the world was like. So at this stage, then, I'm clear that consciousness is very important, that it's real, it's irreducible to material things, so there is more than matter in the universe. That's the first stage of where I go as an idealist. But then you have to ask the question, as you go more deeply into it, well, if there is consciousness, is there such a thing as a continuing self of consciousness? That is there an agent, a subject of consciousness, one being who is conscious of many different things at the same time, sights and sounds and thoughts and feelings, and who is conscious of a chain of experiences continuing through time, and who actually acts as an agent throughout those experiences, being the same agent, changing in character, but being the same agent throughout a continuous stretch of time? Again, a big philosophical question. And I'm not arguing that you have to believe one of these things. I'm just saying this is how it seems to me that the most reasonable way to take it is that there is such a thing as a continuing subject, agent, self. Now, at that point, many empiricists diverge from me. So Freddy Eyre, for example, would say, yes, there is certainly sense data, there's certainly consciousness, but there's no self. There's nothing which has experiences. philosophers who might agree with me there is a continuing self would be Peter Strawson, who was here at Oxford, and would say, no, you can't think of just a chain of experience without anything which connects them, which is not in some sense continuous. So all I'm saying is here's another big problem. I think the world is full of problems. I'm not certain about anything. Don't get me wrong. I'm a priest of the Church of England, and I'm not certain of anything. Okay, there's nothing I'm certain of. Everything is problematic as far as I'm concerned, but I've got to make some decisions. I can't just sit around and say, oh, it's all such a terrible problem, I can't make a decision. So I try to make my decisions, and I say, right, consciousness is important, and I think that the mind is something which you could intelligibly speak of as a continuing agent self. So I've not only got feelings and thoughts, etc., I have an agent. And I don't want to jump into Descartes here, but I'll just say Descartes is very much misunderstood in my view, but that he was quite right in thinking that if you have a continuing consciousness and agency, then you're talking in some sense about a substantial self. That is what, of course, theologians call the soul, or used to call the soul, that continuing self, the subject of experience. Well, keep pressing these sorts of questions and ask this philosophical question. All right, there could be. It's an intelligible supposition that there is a continuing subject and agent of human conscious experiences. But could this subject, could these experiences exist without their material embodiment? Nobody's going to disagree that experiences are materially embodied. Even Descartes said quite clearly there are not, mind and matter are just not just two separate things. They are, he said, indivisibly intertwined so as to form one thing. He made quite a clear statement about that. So you're talking about one thing which is both material and, well, the word is really spiritual. It's not material. It has the attributes of consciousness, thought, feeling, and intention, and we call that the spiritual. So how does the material relate to the spiritual, and are they separable? Well, at this point, again, I would just advert to David Hume, who is a very great philosopher, if wrong about most things. And David Hume said, anything that you can conceive apart, that you can imagine apart, could logically exist apart. Whether it does or not, we don't know, but it could. So at this point, I'll bring Hume to my aid and say, I think you can conceive mental activities existing without there being a physical brain at all. I can imagine it quite easily. And in fact, people didn't know that the brain was the seat of conscious experiences and thoughts until fairly recently in human history. Aristotle thought the brain was a sort of air conditioning unit. So, you know, it's a scientific discovery that the brain is the place where thoughts take place. And I'd want to say, well, yes, all right, there's certainly a very close connection there, but couldn't thoughts and experiences happen without a physical brain? And here I'd say, well, I don't know whether they do, but they certainly could. I'm in no doubt of that. I can stand here and I can imagine that I'd be a bit worried. My arm disappeared and then my body disappeared and then eventually my head disappeared. I disappeared completely, but I go on talking. Words emanate from me. I see you sitting there. Now, you may say, that's very strange, but you know, it's possible. It's logically possible. It's not self-contradictory. And so I do think that minds could exist without physical embodiment. Of course, people who believe in God, you've been waiting for me to say that word, I suppose, people who believe in God think there's at least one mind which is not physically embodied. And I think that's quite conceivable. There may be lots of minds which are not physically embodied. That's a possibility. Well, you want to go a bit further than this and say, well, what difference might that make to the world? Well, the main thing I want to say at this point is that some people who shall be nameless talk about religious belief as though it were belief in something like a flying spaghetti monster, something utterly stupid that nobody's ever really seriously thought about, but for which there's no evidence, and say that's what religious belief is. Well, I simply want to point out that that is a total travesty of the truth. That belief in a mind which is not embodied, which acts to control things that happen in the world, is a totally natural belief. It's not like believing in a spaghetti monster. It's believing that you, as a conscious being who act in the world and who perceive things, could possibly do that while not being embodied, and therefore there could be such a being. It's a logical possibility. And that's a very natural way to think. I believe most humans probably start when they're very young of thinking of the world like that, as a world as a place where intentional causality operates. Now, of course, we know that we cannot now understand the universe as an area where intentional causality operates. And I want to make a distinction, if I can, between two sorts of important explanation, nomological and axiological. Nomological explanation is scientific explanation. It refers to laws. You say, here's a law which says if A, then B. It describes what happens, but it makes no reference to the future. It just says this is a law. You need the initial conditions and the law, then you can perhaps predict. But axiological explanation is explanation in terms of reasons for the sake of which you will do an action. So I give you an axiological explanation of why I am here tonight by saying I thought about it and decided I would like to come. It was something I wanted to do in order to say what my worldview was. Let's just say that's what I thought. So I was doing some action, I was doing something in order to bring about some effect which I thought to be good. Now that's axiological explanation. And I want to say this, I've got to say it quickly, of course, but that axiological explanation is not reducible to nomological explanation. It's a different sort of explanation. So you have many sorts of explanation of the universe, but one of them, which we apply to humans mostly and sometimes to animals, is that you say certainly some things happen because some mind conceives of something and brings about a state of affairs in order that there should be something that they consider to be good to exist. And that gives you the idea, well, could there be a being which did this to the universe? Because we don't do it to the whole universe, only our bit of the universe. So the idea of God is a very natural idea. And that's all I'm wanting to say. It's not a stupid idea. It's not an irrational idea. It naturally arises from consideration of consciousness. And the fact that the best thing known to us is our own conscious experience and our own intentional agency. And it's very difficult, I think, to give a complete explanation of this in purely physical terms. I know very good philosophers are trying to do it. I do not myself believe that any of them has succeeded. And I doubt whether they really believe they've succeeded. They're making good efforts. I applaud the efforts, but I can't see any chance of success. So there I am. I'm an idealist. I believe that mind is more certainly known to us than matter. I'm not even sure what matter is, but I won't go into that. And I think that intentional causality is more fundamental than simply causal law causality, where you say the laws exist, but I don't know why, there's no reason for that. But how do I get from there to religion or to God? Well, since I've now got about 4 minutes left, I'll just say you can be an idealist without believing in God. Idealists include Immanuel Kant, Aristotle, Bradley, a very famous philosopher in the beginning of the 20th century in Britain, and almost every philosopher who occurs on history of ideas syllabuses in universities. They have almost all been idealists. And Kant put this very clearly, the world as it appears to us is a world which is a function of our minds, mind constructed. The world as it is in itself is totally unknown to us, but it is in fact, he thought, an intelligible reality. Okay. It's something not material. It is a spiritual reality. But you don't have to call that God. So how do you get to God? And I'll have to do this again very quickly, but it goes like this. If you become an idealist or somebody sympathetic to thinking, could it be that mind is the most fundamental reality in the universe and that somehow the whole universe exists for the sake of realizing some good and that that's how it came about, if that's a possibility? If that were true, wouldn't it be almost overwhelmingly obvious that this being would reveal something of what its purpose and its nature was? So you'd begin perhaps to look for instances of revelation or where there's been a claim that somebody has managed to be a vehicle of a revelation from the mind of the universe. And I think as a Christian, I find in the person of Jesus a revelation of the nature and purpose of God, which is namely that there's something of ultimate, absolute value about human personal flourishing and human life. And this is a categorical obligation that you must revere every human life and your own. And personhood, in the sense of the flourishing of conscious abilities and capacities, is a religious obligation. And it's a participation in the being of the God who is revealed in Jesus Christ, because if you say that as a Christian that God was incarnate in a human person, there are many different understandings of that, but one of them is simply that God was showing that the human person is sacred. It has that quality of categorical obligation. It's something you have to respect. You have, it's a moral have to. So the path from idealism to religion for me was in fact autobiographically a path from atheism to Christianity. You don't have to be a Christian, you don't have to be an idealist, but I'm just saying this is the way that one philosopher has gone, and I could give you 100 philosophers who have been idealists. They haven't all been Christian, but Christianity becomes a reasonable claim that the mind of the universe, the consciousness which gives rise to everything material, without which perhaps there wouldn't be anything material at all, I really do believe that, that mind has disclosed in a mysterious and ambiguous way, but it has disclosed in a way clear enough for us to commit our lives to it, that the purpose is the flourishing of human personal life. And that's why I'm a personal idealist, and I would just end by saying I think it's very reasonable to commit yourself to something which you found to be categorically obligatory, even though it is objectively uncertain if it's of great importance to the continuance and flourishing of your life and your way of living in the universe. Thank you.
And now I invite Arif to give his presentation.
Okay, thank you very much, Keith, for that very interesting talk. When I was asked to do this talk, the organisers of the session suggested that I address five questions, and I think these are the five questions that are on the programme. And since unlike Keith, I'm not really capable of organising my own thoughts for myself, they all come in a sort of enormous bundle. It's useful to me to be able to follow roughly that scheme. So what I'll do is I'm going to say something about the nature of my worldview, the causes for why I had it, some reasons for believing it, some misconceptions about it, and some of its effects. And on the way, I'll try to say something about some of the points that Keith made in his interesting talk. But before I do any of that, I just want to register protest at the expression worldview used in the title of this discussion, because it has at least one connotation, which is that, or has the suggestion, that there might be various different incompatible worldviews, as they're called, that differ so fundamentally that, in fact, in some sense, they're all equally legitimate, despite being conflicting, and no one of them is right, but you can have one worldview and somebody else can have another, and there's no right or wrong, there's just lots of different worldviews. And that seems to me objectionable on both logical and ethical grounds. It's objectionable on logical grounds simply because one of the first things that you're taught in logic is that a proposition is either true or false, and if it's true, it's true, and if it's false, it's false. And having a false proposition dancing around in your head with lots of other false propositions doesn't make it or any of the rest of them true. It means that they're all false. So I don't really understand the notion of a worldview if it's meant to have the connotation I suggested. The second ethical reason for objecting to this way of thinking about things is that, of course, if you believe that there can be many competing worldviews, then it seems to leave the door open for a variety of worldviews that are hospitable to things like, for instance, homeopathy. There might be a worldview in which homeopathy works, or there might be a worldview in which astrology works, or there might be a worldview in which, you know, the Holocaust never happened or something like that. So you can defend any array of a range of beliefs, which I should like to call straightforwardly false, by saying that actually it belongs to a different worldview. And that seems to me, as I said, both on logical and ethical grounds, a cop-out. Therefore, I don't want to say that I'm going to describe my worldview. What I'm going to do is I'm going to state certain beliefs in propositions that I think are both important and true and of some generality, and I hope that that will be of some interest to you. Turning now to my own beliefs, I suppose the ones that are most important in this context are my basic philosophical view and my view about religion. And the answers to those things can be stated in two words. So my basic philosophical outlook is what is called empiricist. This is something I think Keith mentioned. And my view about religion is the view of atheism. So let me just state what those two things amount to. Empiricism, as I'm understanding it tonight, amounts to the thesis that if you take a proposition, you can dress it up however you like, in as fancy a way as you want, mathematical language, philosophical language, any sort of technicality. The only reasons for believing that it's true or for believing that it's false depend on observations. So that, for instance, belief in whether a drug works, whether a certain historical event happens, whether you're here tonight, whether a certain person was resurrected 2,000 years ago, all of these things are settled, if they can be settled at all, on the basis of observation. Now, observation, as I'm understanding it here, is to be understood in a very liberal sense. So I don't, of course, mean just what happens in a lab, though, of course, in laboratories, experience is tested in a relatively rigorous and careful way. It includes all kinds of things, including everyday experience. Nobody needs to run an experiment in a lab to know that when you hit your finger with a hammer, it's going to hurt. But the reason we believe that is nevertheless compatible with empiricism, because it's a product of the everyday experience of most of us. So the notion of experience is here to be understood in quite a broad and everyday sense that I hope is familiar to all of you. Now, it's a corollary of that that there are various things that couldn't be reasons for believing something. So if it's comforting to believe that something's true, that's not a reason to believe it. If it's natural, in the sense that I think what Keith meant by that was that many children believe it, that's not a reason to believe it. If it makes you a better person, that's not a reason to believe it. The only grounds for believing something to be true or false are ultimately observational. And if you have different views that can't be settled by observation, that means, you know, objective testing either in a lab or by everyday experience, then unless logic itself can settle it, the matter is simply a guess. There's just no saying which one is true and which one is false. Now, I should distinguish that view from two other views. Empiricism is not materialism. Okay? Empiricism, Berkeley thought, for instance, that empiricism and materialism are incompatible. Whether or not that's true, certainly empiricism doesn't entail materialism. So I'm an empiricist, as I said, but that doesn't mean I think everything's bits of matter whizzing around. Of course not. What we believe in, what we think exists, is whatever is postulated by theories that account for what we observe. So the theories that account for what we observe, if they postulate things like fields and gravitational fields or numbers or any of the other paraphernalia of modern scientific theory, because that plays a role in explaining what we observe and does so better than other theories which don't do that, that's a reason to believe in all of those things. So there need be no commitment at all to materialism in the empiricist view, which, as I said, is just an approach to settling questions which otherwise, it seems, could only be settled by guessing. The second thesis that I want to discuss after empiricism is, of course, atheism. And the content of the atheist thesis is that, you know, I don't believe that there's any conscious being who both created and sustained the universe and who is the source of value. I don't think any one thing has all of those properties, and in fact, I don't think any one thing has any of those properties. So there is no such thing. That means, of course, I don't believe that the Christian God exists, and for exactly the same reasons, which I shall come to shortly, I don't believe in Allah or Vishnu or Jupiter or Thor or Father Christmas or any of the other paraphernalia of the Christian religion, such as angels, resurrections, virgin births, particular providence, and so on. Nor do I believe, like some of my more excitable colleagues, that we are all part of a computer simulation that was designed by superintelligent aliens, which is another thing that I'm amazed about that as well. So much for the content of my beliefs. Let me just now say a little bit about their causes. Of course, like many children, I had what Keith, I think, would call a natural belief in Father Christmas when I was young. So, of course, I started out believing in Father Christmas. That was a kind of starting point. It was initially rational, as you might say. And I believed it because where else would all the presents come from and so on. So it's a natural thing to believe. And as I grew older, I stopped believing in it for two reasons. I mean, one reason was that, both to do with empiricism, one reason was that there seems to be an alternative explanation for the things that I observed which made me believe in him, because, you know, the presence didn't come from him. And the second thing was the fact that it was absurd to believe in it on the grounds of observation. I mean, nobody could travel that fast in one evening, so I had no reason to believe in him. Now, that step from not believing in Father, from believing in Father Christmas to not believing in him, was exactly parallel to the step that I took not that long afterwards, from believing in, or at least suspecting in, the existence of some divinity to not believing in that divinity. There's nothing that we observe that needs to be explained by such a postulation. I would challenge anyone here tonight to give me an example of some observed some experiment or some recorded result that demands that we postulate the existence of a divinity who is both the creator of the universe and the source of all values, let alone the other matters to do with resurrection, angels, and so on. And the second thing was, of course, that it involves postulating beliefs about him that seemed to be incompatible with all of the laws we know about how the universe works. And in particular, in the Christian religion, one's required to believe that a certain person died, and then, in fact, more than one, but certainly at least one person died and then came back to life after a short while, and also various other miracles, which, of course, seemed to me to be ludicrous for the very same reasons that the belief in Father Christmas was ludicrous. So that's a little bit about the route I personally took towards that belief. Now, there were other personal facts as well concerning my own route from religion, but those are to do with my feelings, and I'm sure, you know, you're not interested in knowing about my feelings, so I won't discuss them. Let me turn now perhaps to the question on which I want to focus the most tonight, which is to do with the plausibility of the questions. So we have to distinguish between reasons for believing something and causes for believing something. And I want to just go over some of the things that Keith said at this point, because you might think that they give us reasons for doubting some of the things I've said about atheism. One thing I'd like to turn to is his distinction between what he calls nomological or scientific explanation on the one hand, and what you might call axiological or personal explanation on the other hand. And as he said correctly, and I agree with this, that axiological explanation is a manner in which we can explain the behaviour, for instance, of human beings and other non-human animals. Now, that's correct, but of course, when you try to give an axiological explanation, for the explanation to be even remotely plausible, you have to fulfil the following two conditions. On the one hand, there must be a reason for thinking that there is actually some intentional agency involved in the matter. And on the other hand, there must be a reason for thinking that this particular axiological or personal explanation is more plausible than any of the many other ones that you could give. So let me give an example of that. If you see somebody running down the street, then, you know, you might, if you want, I suppose, try to explain it in terms of movements of muscles and firings and neurons and electrons and so on. But of course, it would be much simpler, and it would count as something that deserves to be called an explanation, to say, well, he was trying to catch the bus. Okay, that seems a good explanation of why the person was running. But notice that the reason that counts as even a plausible explanation is because we already have evidence of two things. We have evidence that there is a possibility of intentional or axiological explanation here, because we can see that it's a person, the sort of thing, you know, to whom we standardly attribute minds. They explain their behaviour in plenty of other contexts. So we have some prima facie reason for supposing that there's an axiological explanation in the offing in the first place. And the second one is that, given the context, given perhaps what we know about this person or where he's running and so on, we have reasons for preferring this particular explanation, that he's running to catch the bus, over any of the many other axiological explanations that we could have given. For instance, that he was running away from someone or something like that. Now, in the case of divinity, or the spiritual entity that underlies the universe, neither of these conditions are met. So there is no reason at all for the whole, when we come to the universe as a whole, as well as this is being true for many parts of it, there's no reason at all to think that here we are even in the market for anything like an axiological or personal explanation. Explanations of that sort have a terrifically bad track record when it comes to explaining the behaviour of anything other than human beings and animals. And again, I would challenge anyone to give the slightest bit of evidence tonight that we should even think in terms of axiological or personal explanation here, given that we never do nowadays when we try to explain the behaviour of such things as the waves or the wind or the motion of the planets or the digestive system or any of the many other physical processes that we observe all the time. The second point, which is independent of that, is that the second condition for such explanations is also not met. There's no plausibility to supposing that, there's no reason to suppose that this universe was created because somebody wanted to fulfill certain values, certain being wanted to fulfill certain values. Of course, as Keith said, it could be true, but notice that when he says something could be true, he just means it in the sense that Hume meant that it was possible, which is to say no contradiction is involved. That's all that's meant by saying it could be true. I mean, in that sense, it could be true that trees should grow limbs and walk, or that I should fly up 10 feet into the air spontaneously, or that any of the many other things that we're quite certain will never happen and never have happened should happen right now. All of those things, in that sense, could be true, but of course saying that something could be true in that sense isn't to give a shred of evidence for it. Yep. So it seems to me that there's no particular reason, as far as I can see, for thinking that the particular kind of axiological explanation that Keith was suggesting is one that has any plausibility at all in this case. The other point I would make about empiricism and its plausibility, and this is really something that pertains more to my own view rather than to Keith's, is that it is something that we apply all the time in most of our lives. You wouldn't, for instance, take a drug unless there have been plenty of observations and tests that have been done to show that it was safe. That's empirical testing. You wouldn't go in a plane unless the plane had been tested rigorously by engineers and so on to make sure that it wouldn't fall apart halfway through the air. And in fact, the more important the thing is, as in cases like drugs and planes, the more rigorous the empirical and observational testing that you would require in order to commit yourself to it. How much more certain should we be then, or how much more experience should we need in order to believe this thing, which is, if true, the most important proposition in the universe, the one thing on which our whole lives depend, and which, if it were true, should make us all change our lives completely, or those of you who are not Christians would change your life altogether if you actually believed that this was true. And yet, as I said, when we look at the evidence, so here again, prescinding completely from the question whether it could be true, when we look at the evidence, it seems as if there's no evidence whatever. Or at least nothing in the talk that we've been given tonight by Keith gives us the slightest reason to think there's any evidence. All that he's shown is that it could be true in that very weak sense I described, but that was something we knew already. Let me turn finally to a couple of points, one to do with a misconception about the worldview that I just described, and another one to do with its effects. Very briefly, the misconception that I had various misconceptions I wanted to mention, but I think I'll just mention one of them, which was that you might think that it leads to a very arid and empty spiritual view of the world, because you think, well, you know, your life has no meaning if there's no God, and the world isn't, the universe is a cold, empty place, and there's, you know, nothing is worthwhile. None of that seems to me to be true. Certainly, it doesn't follow logically from the fact that that there is no one person who gives value to everything, that there are no values at all. More generally, I've never understood why, if life has an end, that should make it more meaningless than saying that anything else that has an end must also be meaningless. Or if it is, then what purpose is served by stretching life out forever, as though that's somehow the fact that after this life is appended some afterlife that goes on forever suddenly gives the whole thing meaning that some smaller bit of it didn't have. Maybe there's some reason for believing that I'm not appreciating. In any case, I think that persons can produce meanings for themselves. They can have their own values in life, and there is no one single source of value. I value certain things, different people value different other things, and it's not as though one of them is right and the other one is wrong and there's only one possible source of meaning. The final thing I want to say just concerns the effects of what has been called this worldview, but by which I really mean just these beliefs. And I'll just mention a couple of effects. One of them is that It makes you open, intellectually more open, I think, if you're not religious than if you are, at least to a range of different patterns of thought. So, for instance, I'm open, you know, not being religious, my ethical thought is not constrained by any religious precepts or commands, and so I suppose I'm more open than I would have been otherwise. Maybe people who are more intellectually flexible are not like this, but I myself am more open than I would have been otherwise to a whole range of very rich and interesting philosophical thought on ethical questions, for instance, by Mill, let's say, or by Hume, or by Kant, or by other very profound thinkers, to which I myself, I feel, would probably not have been so receptive had I been constrained by the demands of the Christian religion and the ethical impositions that makes. The second effect, I would say, is more negative, because, of course, I understand that for many people, religious belief, I mean, obviously, I'm a very fortunate person, and my life has been very lucky in many ways, and I lead a very sheltered and comfortable existence, and for many people, religious beliefs can be a comfort in much more difficult times than I've ever had to face. And I can see that should be so, even for myself. You know, I imagine there are times where religious belief would be an enormous comfort. Even in the more abstract level, thinking about things like death, of course, death would be horrific. I don't want to die. Nobody wants to die, I guess. And the idea, I don't agree with some atheists who think that's fine. I think the idea that I'm going to die in a certain number of years is not something that I look forward to, and I wish it wasn't true. I would love it if it was true that I could come back to life after my death. That would be terrific. And if it turned out the Christian religion was true, or at least at that point if Christianity was true, I'd be really pleased. I mean, I'd convert, and then I'd be pleased. So for that reason, it has a certain negative effect. I mean, it doesn't make me happier about some things that matter to me greatly, the fact that I believe these things. But I suppose I should end by emphasising a point that I stated earlier on when I was talking about empiricism itself, which is that a reason for believing something is not because it makes you happier or because it makes you a better person or because it's a form of comfort at times, at difficult times. The only reason for believing it is because it's true. Thanks very much.
Right, well, thank you both, Arif and Keith, for those opening presentations. So we're going to move into a time of just talking through some of the things that we heard there. And as I said, if you've got any questions, do be thinking of those, and we'll be coming to them a little bit later on. Perhaps, Keith, first of all, you'd like to respond to some of what Arif had to say there. Arif was keen to suggest that you didn't actually present any evidence for God. You said there's nothing incompatible with the existence of God. It's logically possible, but Arif said, look here, we're interested in, that could mean the tooth fairy's there. That's not incompatible. But, what do you say in response?
Right. I'm quite pleased with small gains these days, and even to have some good philosopher say, oh, that's possible, in a very arcane sense. I'm quite pleased about that, so thank you for saying it. At least it's possible. But I've got to say a bit more than that. What struck me most about what you said, Arif, was your very strong emphasis on evidence. I can understand that, but I suppose I doubt whether you're right in saying that we should only believe things if we have observational evidence for them, or if they're good explanations in a sort of nomological way, so a scientific type explanation for what happens. And I doubt if that's right. And I think it's worth reflecting just on what is a good reason for a belief that we might stake our life on. And I don't think I would have done most things that I have done in my life if I'd waited for good evidence for the beliefs that I had in the background of my mind. I think William James wrote, I still think, a very good essay on this, on the will to believe, and if it was ever true that you should commit yourself to something for which you didn't have really overwhelming evidence. And that's the bit I'd like to focus on. The bit that neither of us really mentioned, but was certainly at the back of my mind, was, of course, religion is not about seeking evidence for God. People don't go into churches in white coats with microscopes and see if they can find God anywhere. That's just not what's going on at all. So I think what you're doing there is aligning religion with science and then saying it doesn't work. That's not the way it works. I agree, it doesn't work as science. So I don't think that's what's going on. People who are religious pray, and they meditate, and they contemplate. And that's what religion is about. It's about a sense or a longing for union with a mind that is greater and wiser and more loving than yours. And if that element of experience didn't exist, I think religion wouldn't exist at all. I mean, lots of bad things about religion, but the good thing about it is when it says your life can be actually changed by a wisdom and a love which is coming from a source beyond yourself. So that's the only sort of evidence that I would really put in a primary position, I think. I don't like talking about proofs of God or arguments for God. I'm not saying they don't have a place, but they wouldn't. I mean, we're both philosophers. We both know we could talk about arguments for God for years and never really come to something that would overwhelmingly persuade anybody. So I wouldn't go that way. I would say, all right, if God is a possibility, why not see whether it's a reality in experience? So that's what I'd be focusing on. And just a word about Father Christmas, if I may. Of course, the reason we don't believe in Father Christmas is we know that our parents were lying to us. We know that. So I think the different stages. First of all, you are right to trust your parents. But when they admitted they were lying, your trust is undermined, actually. That's quite a difficult problem about Father Christmas. But it's not that nobody has seriously thought there was a Father Christmas. So I think it's a bit of an unfair example. People have seriously thought they have knowledge of a spiritual being who is greater and more wiser than they are. Whereas Father Christmas is just one of those things.
Do you find the Father Christmas analogy rather like the flying spaghetti monster analogy you were talking about?
I do, because nobody seriously believes in Father Christmas. I think the point was, and I agree with this point, children should trust what they're told by their parents, but as they grow up, they should find out their parents are not omniscient.
Okay, smashing, thanks. So there's about three or four things I want to pick up on there. Let's just start with the point about Father Christmas. Well, I did believe, I seriously believe that he existed at a certain age. I won't embarrass myself by saying how old that was. And then I didn't stop the belief because my parents admitted that they were lying to me about it. They never admitted that, and they still don't. But I found out because I worked out for myself where the presents were coming, and B, that nobody could get around that fast on one night. So it was indeed a genuine belief. The point about, so as you give the example, the second point concerning the flying spaghetti monster, Father Christmas, all of these other things, the purpose to which it's been put by many atheists, including Russell, who invented probably the most famous example, was not that the belief is somehow natural, the one that we all have, but that exactly the same evidence exists to support it. And as I said earlier, my own position is, and I think this is a plausible one, that if there isn't any evidence for something, you shouldn't believe it, regardless of whether you used to believe it when you were a child. Now, going on to the point about... I wasn't quite sure about the issue concerning small gains and possibilities, because maybe you don't appreciate just how small a gain this is. I mean, the claim that the thing is possible, of course it's possible because it's false. That's why it's meaningful, because it's false. I think it's false, therefore I'm committed to saying that it's meaningful and therefore possible in some very loose and light sense. But as I also said, that notion of possibility extends to the tooth fairy, the belief that, you know, tomorrow trees will grow legs and walk and talk, and all of the other things which none of us, A, believe for a moment, and B, would actually stake our lives on not believing. Okay, and we all believe that, you know, the next time we go up in a plane, it'll crash. It's possible it won't crash. It's possible that it will, but of course it's something that we stake our lives on. And so saying that something's possible is quite compatible with saying that you should stake your life on it's not being true. So if that's a gain that's existed since the formulation of this language, which has been for more than 4,000 years, I suppose, not a gain that's been made tonight. The last thing I wanted to pick on was the point about prayer, because I wasn't quite sure I understood that. At one point you said it's a sort of experience or a sort of evidence or something like that. Well, there is such a thing as people having certain kind of mental stimulations when they pray, and I'll have other sorts of religious experiences as well, been well documented. It's been studied by neuropsychologists and so on, and there are various interesting theories about the brain states that cause them. None of that gives us any reason to think that that's, you know, none of it is evidence of any external agency acting upon them. Quite the opposite. I challenge anyone to give me a documented case where, you know, anything like that is a plausible explanation. Oh, yes, one final thing, if I may. Mm-hmm. And this just concerned the thing that you said at the beginning about committing yourself. This is something I suppose I don't understand, because in many other examples of cases where there's a belief which committing to ourselves means staking your life, like flying on a plane to France tomorrow, that's you're committing your life to something, or taking a drug, you're staking your life on something. And these are precisely not cases where we should make a leap in the absence of evidence. These are the cases where we demand evidence most strongly. And it seems to me that religious belief, if it is genuine, is a case where that demand is actually raised, you know, is the same, but raised to an even higher degree. So I suppose that's five points. Can I now ask Keith something? Or is that...
Well, should we just get a quick response to maybe a couple of those things, Keith? I mean, Arif seems to be suggesting that you're committing yourself to something without enough evidence. Now, you've suggested that that's not the way we do things all the time in the world, that we don't sort of have to have a certain amount of observational evidence in order to commit ourselves to things, and God might be one of those things. I mean, it did strike me in your presentation that you weren't just making this case that, well, it's not logically incompatible and therefore, you know, I'm happy to believe it, but that there seemed to be some grounds from what you were saying in terms of the way you conceive the world, this consciousness, our thoughts, and you certainly feel that gives you good grounds for not believing in materialism. That was where you were coming from. And that this has a potential sort of knock-on effect to, well, if we can conceive of unembodied minds, there may be one great unembodied mind that, as it were, gives rise to these things, that's a sort of an explanation of sorts. So I suppose I'm trying to ask, is there a sort of positive case that you're trying to make as well?
Oh, yes, very definitely. Let me just first say that I'm so old that I was taught by Freddie Eyre as well, and that's my gain of logical possibility, because Freddie Eyre said at one time, I'm not even an atheist because the word God has no meaning. So that's the sort of background I'm reacting to.
I am an atheist.
Right. Yeah, so I'm happy with that. I'm happy with that, really. But, of course, Eyre changed his mind, but that's another question. Now, on the one about evidence and religious experience and so on, even if you don't talk about religious experience, my talk about the problem of consciousness and the reality of consciousness was not meant to be an abstract mere possibility, but an experiential fact, which was very important for your interpretation of what the world was. What I was implicitly trying to say, as an idealist, remember, I gave the clue as to where this all lies, that I'm not certain of the independent reality of the material world at all. That means my view of evidence is not going to be quite the same as yours. I mean, I do agree if I'm going to a plane, I want evidence for how the plane works, etc. But there are lots of things where it would actually be improper to ask for evidence. Now, think of that sort of case. What sort of cases would they be? Well, I think it would be improper if before I married my wife, I hired a private detective to get evidence about whether she fulfilled the requirements that I really had in mind. There's certain things that you take on trust in personal relationships. Now, trust is a very important word. Of course, trust, the word pistis in the New Testament means trust, and it means faith. So faith is a matter of trust in something. Now, the evidence just doesn't seem right. So, of course, there are lots of areas, and you've mentioned many of them, where you would want as much evidence as possible. In fact, I agree with you, you would always want as much evidence as possible. What I'm asking is, aren't there important things in life where you can't get the evidence, and you don't have time to get the evidence anyway. You possibly couldn't even get the evidence, but you have to make a commitment. Or I think even certain moral questions, if I just advert to that for a moment, and you say, is it true that you ought to give 10% of your money to charity? Is that true? And you say, well, is there evidence for that? And I think it just would be an improper question, but you have to commit yourself to doing it or not. You try to make a reasonable decision. So I suppose I'm suggesting there are areas of life, religion is one of them, morality is another, where reasonable decisions don't wholly depend on evidence, but you have to make a commitment because you think it's good. But if somebody says to you, can you prove to me that it's good? You have to say, well, it's not that sort of thing. No, I can't prove it. Don't you feel that? And they might say, no, I don't. And then there's nothing you can do, but there's no evidence you can produce. But it's very important to you. So I think personal relationships in general are a bit like that. There are many things in personal relationships where evidence would seem somehow unworthy or improper, and you know, you make a commitment to people.
Okay, good. So on the point about the wife example, I agree it would be improper to hire a private detective to follow your wife around, either, you know, certainly after you've married her, that would be a bad idea. But of course, I was construing the notion of experience in a very broad way, so they didn't just include things like going around looking for evidence. It simply meant responsiveness to what you actually observe. So presumably before you married your wife, I'm not being personal, but presumably before somebody marries their wife, you know, they have at least some positive experiences with that person. You know, they have some occasions where this person observably either smiles at them or audibly says things like, you know, I think you're really charming, or you know, all of the other things that people supposedly do before they get married. And these are all facts of experience. And if you didn't have those experiences, it would be a funny thing to marry that person. Now, that seems to me precisely the kind of sensitivity to experience that I meant to include in that rather broad and loose notion of empiricism that is very important to me. The second thing you said was just concerning whether you have time or not. And you're quite right, there are going to be cases where you have to make very important decisions, all the evidence isn't in, and you just don't, you know, you just don't have the time. It's better to make a wrong decision than no decision on that particular case. Many examples come to mind. This is not one of them. We've got all our lives to make the decision, most of us. We're sitting here in a room now thinking about it for, you know, an hour and a half, and people like you and I have the luxury of being able to spend large portions of our life thinking about it. So this is not a case...
I don't know.
I'd be interested to find out from you, Arif, your worldview. You sort of had a bit of a problem with the concept of a worldview, but you say you're an atheist, yes. You're an empiricist. Yes. Now, I wasn't sure whether you did in the end say your empiricism, the way you evaluate the evidence around you, has led you to the thing that Keith started out criticising, which was materialism, i.e. that material stuff is all there is in the world. Yeah. I'd just be interested to know, is that actually where you do stand, or are you not quite that far?
Okay, good, thanks. That was probably something I should have made a little bit clearer in the talk. No, I want to distinguish empiricism from materialism quite sharply. So Bishop Berkeley, for instance, thought they were not even compatible. They couldn't both be true. But certainly I think you can be an empiricist without being a materialist. I myself don't think the world consists just of a bit of matter whizzing around. I believe, for one thing, in, you know, abstract objects like numbers, for instance, or gravitational fields, or it may be that physical theories don't postulate matter at all. They just postulate force fields like electromagnetic and gravitational fields and so on. And these aren't thought of as material in the way that we standardly think of things as material. So that very simplistic 17th century view of the world, that everything is bits of matter buzzing around, is something that people could have been excused for holding then, but I think is probably not even compatible with empiricism and our scientific knowledge today.
Where do you go with Keith's view that thoughts, feelings, just the stuff we encounter all the time is a bit of a problem for a materialist worldview, or indeed probably the worldview you hold, that it needs a bit more explanation than...
Okay, good. Well, I mean, I'm not... And one thing I'll say is I'm not entirely convinced that it is a problem for materialism itself. Just on that point, though, I'm not a materialist. The materialist who reduces thoughts, who says these thoughts are just nervous events of one sort or another, he's not denying they exist, right? He's not what's called an eliminativist. Maybe Dennett is that, but you don't have to be that. You can say they do exist, they are neuronal firings, but they do exist, so you needn't deny their existence. On the other hand, I'm not committed to that view, but I do think, as an empiricist, of course consciousness is real. Of course, at least there are beliefs and thoughts and so on. They form part of what you might call an explanation, an adequate explanation, of things we observe like human behaviour, so there's plenty of reason to believe in them. Does that mean that I think there's some immaterial foundation of the universe? That not only doesn't follow, it isn't remotely plausible. We have no evidence of that.
But can I just take you up on this? You mentioned the name of Dan Dennett, which is always calculated to arouse me. and he is an eliminativist materialist, so he thinks you could reduce conscious events to brain events. Now, you don't agree with this. Right. Have you got evidence for your disagreement?
The evidence would be, it would be a scientific matter. Basically, it's a question of whether or not the best explanation of what happens, of what we observe, can be done without adverting to these things.
Yeah, but he thinks he's got the best explanation.
Yeah, I don't agree.
I know you don't agree. Yeah, yeah. So What is the evidence telling you? Is the evidence deciding the issue?
No, the evidence doesn't decide the issue
for me. So what does?
What, and further evidence? I mean, the point is just that there isn't enough evidence that settles it yet.
No, I'm putting it to you. You're making a decision, a commitment, for which you don't have evidence in the sense publicly available material which would convince any reasonable person of what the truth was. And I think in this case, eliminative materialism versus the sort of empiricism you hold, there's a big disagreement, and it could have quite severe consequences about how you treat people and their experiences, but there's no evidence to decide the issue, and we can't even think of what the evidence would be, but we come to a decision.
Okay, maybe I should just set out my position. I think that's a misunderstanding of my position, but if I just state it again more clearly, it's my fault. Maybe we can see. So, yes, I believe in empiricism. I believe that there are conscious states, sensations and so on. I don't think materialism is true. If materialism is the doctrine that all there is are bits of matter, I think that's false. Okay. The question of the eliminative view, which is the view that sensations don't exist, or other bits of consciousness don't exist, that's something for which I don't believe it to be true, and I don't yet believe it to be false. I have what you might say a certain intermediate degree of belief or something like that, just like we do in many propositions on which we take bets. I mean, that seems to be a natural thing to allow, that you can have intermediate degrees of belief which don't involve commitment, but you can be 50-50 on a matter, for instance, so you'd bet a certain amount, wouldn't bet more, for instance. That seems a perfectly reasonable state of mind to have, and that's the state of mind you should be in when all the evidence is not in. That's not my state of mind when it comes to God.
I think you're a philosopher with certain views,
yes,
for which there is no evidence in the sense of any observable entity which would make any sensible person agree with you.
Okay, good. Can you state for me the belief that I have for which there is no evidence?
That you have a belief that conscious states exist in addition to and not reducible to material states of the brain.
No, I didn't say I don't believe that.
You don't believe that?
No, I don't believe that to be true, and I don't believe it to be false. I'm sort of
You're a complete agnostic.
I'm agnostic on that matter.
Oh,
yes.
So my mental states are aching as we speak. I suppose what I'd like to do before we come to some questions, gentlemen, is sort of ask, look, you're both philosophers, you're both incredibly clever, you've looked at the same evidence, you've come to different conclusions about the nature of the universe. Okay, you believe there is no God, you believe there is a God, Keith. And what I'm trying to decide is it sort of just a flick of the coin, and there's evidence that you see, which is sort of puts it into one category, evidence that you see that takes it the other direction. Is it just down to, at the end of the day, experience? You talked about the importance of experience in this sort of thing, Keith.
Yeah.
When it comes down to it, if you like, and going back to one of these questions in our pamphlet, what are the main reasons that make this view credible to you? Why theism rather than atheism?
Okay, can I have a go at that? Now, I'll have to become an evangelist for a moment. You'll forgive this, but I can't answer the question without saying this. The real reason why I became a Christian is because I looked at my life and thought it's a bloody mess. I'm committed to an immoral way of life, which is perfectly acceptable to everybody else, but not to me. How do I get out of it? I faced a sense of utter failure, actually, of the things that I felt I ought to be committed to. And I had a particular experience, a psychological experience, of Christ, as it seemed to me, liberating me from that sense of frustration and futility, and being a positive, vital force for putting my life in a new direction. Okay, so that was that experience. That's why I became a Christian, because I believe that that Christ was a spiritual power other than me, which agreed with what people, Christians, were telling me it was like and changed my life. So that's why. But without the philosophy, I would have just said that's simply a neurological event that somebody will explain later on. Okay, so that was my... So that's why the philosophy is important to me. It opens up the possibility of taking your spiritual experiences seriously, but it's not the tipping point.
Okay, so you had the philosophy which told you, it seems to me that atheism, naturalism, materialism is not all there is, and I've had this experience, which is then best explained in the context of the Christian God had...
So obviously, I don't know whether experience then can count in any way for you. Does are obviously very subjective experiences of people who claim to have had an experience of Christ or whatever. Can that be fitted into empiricism, or is it by definition kind of counted out?
No, I don't think it's by definition counted out. I suppose, I mean, going back to the analogy with other things that matter, I mean, if there was a drug you wanted to take, let's say, and it turned out that, you know, the only evidence that it did any good was based on the supposed personal experiences of, say, some small proportion of the people who took it, they disagreed about exactly what good that it did, and the supposed good that it did could never be reproduced in any experiment that was run anywhere in the history of the world, then that would seem to me not very strong evidence for risking my life on that drug. And it seems to me religion is the same in the sense that, you know, these testimonies of religious experiences vary from one person to another all over the world, typically has something to do with their prior beliefs and religious upbringings. There's some evidence concerning the activity of the brain is to do with memories when they have these experiences, not to do with incoming experiences. So for these reasons, I'm not inclined to take such things very seriously. Going back to your other question about whether it's a flip of the coin or not, I suppose, I mean, in a sense, it's a flip of the coin, but the coin has many sides, including Christianity and Islam and Judaism and Hinduism and each of the 50 or 60,000 so other religions that have been held by people all over the world, all of which, as far as I can see, have exactly the same support as Christianity.
I suppose when I was thinking the flip was theism or atheism, I admit there are many, you know, brands of theism in the world.
Yeah, good.
But when it comes to just whether there is some ultimate guiding force, call it what
okay,
you will.
Good. Yeah, well, no.
Is it a flip of the
on
coin?
No, it's not a flip on the coin, because on that question, just like whether there's a tooth fairy or other things, and again, this is simply a matter of evidence, that we've heard no reason tonight to believe, and I'm not aware of a single reason, to believe that there is a single spiritual entity which is both creates and sustains the universe and is the source of all value. That's what I'm being asked to believe, I guess, as a theist.
So you discount all religious experiences throughout the world, even though, as a matter of fact, it is true, isn't it, that the majority of philosophers in our tradition have been theists of one sort or another. Right? That's true.
That may well be true.
I mean, you're in the minority.
So I'm not just saying numbers, I'm saying that there is it's not just a few little people who have some very odd experiences. It's the widespread testimony of people who've thought most deeply and experienced most widely, and they seem to think, well, there does exist, and we can experience a reality which is other than any embodied human person, but has personal type characteristics, as though it's as though you're taking a personalistic or reactive attitude to the universe rather than an objective and dispassionate one. And that's why the evidence is not such an important thing, because it's a matter of trust or distrust. I think this is evidence of a different kind, you know, to be taken seriously. If these people say, look, this actually is what makes my life and the lives of people around me worthwhile. It's not just that it's comforting; it makes them harder, perhaps. I think that's serious evidence.
Okay, good. On the point about philosophers, I guess there's a couple of things. I mean, one thing is that, of course, the proportion of philosophers, just like the proportion of scientists who have claimed to believe in God, has fallen as we've learned more about the physical world. As science has advanced, maybe those two things are correlated. I'm not claiming I can prove that they are, but it's certainly that it's fallen, and I should say the majority of professional philosophers today are not Christian or have any other religion. Second thing I would say is that you don't want to run together what I thought I heard you running together in that what you said just now, which is religious beliefs and religious experiences, which are two separate things. So Kant, for instance, certainly had religious beliefs, but he didn't think you could have, I guess, religious experiences. The third point just concerns how much we believe things that people say about some subjects just because they're brilliant at various other things or expert on other subjects. Aristotle, who is probably the greatest genius of antiquity, thought that men had more teeth than women. He never thought to look inside Mrs. Aristotle's head and count them, which is another example of how experience trumps.
We should start to just wind our conversation up to a close. I want to leave some time for questions. So thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been really good. Now, as we move to a question time, I think we've got a roving mic somewhere up there. Can one of the sound folk show me the microphone? Oh, there we are. One here and one up there. Great. So we've got both ends of the room covered. We'll take questions for both Keith
and Arif. If you have a question, what I'll ask is for you to be as concise as you can. We're not looking for speeches of any kind, but just one question, and then to hand the microphone back to the person who hands it to you. And what we'll do is, if that's directed at Arif, he'll speak to it for a couple of minutes max, and then Keith will be able to give a short commentary on that as well, and vice versa if the question is for Keith. OK, well, with that in mind, let's go ahead and take a few questions. So if you've got a question, do stick your hand up. And we've got a few down here. Do you want to start here in this corner with the gentleman there? Great, thank you.
Yes, I have a question for Dr. Ahmed. Euclid never saw a point. He never saw a line. He had no empirical evidence that they existed, and yet developed a whole mathematics that has survived for 2,000 years. How does that fit into your empiricism?
Yep. Okay, thanks. So the empiricism is not the view held, for instance, by the 18th century empiricists, that we only have reason to believe in things that we directly observe. I was trying to distance myself from that, though I probably didn't do so explicitly enough. The view is that we have reason to believe theories that explain what we observe, and that it's what we observe that adjudicates between the alternative theories. Now, in the case of Euclidean geometry, of course, although it's correct that nobody's observed a line or a point as those are understood in Euclid's geometry, I mean, I suppose the edge between two colours might be thought of as a line, as having no width, but anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is that it does form part of a theory which is confirmed by experience almost every day. The fact that, you know, this is roughly rectangular and that if you add up the internal angles they come to 360 degrees is an indirect but nevertheless an experiential confirmation of that theory.
Do you want to add anything to that, Keith?
No, except I agree with the implication of what the question asked. I think mathematics...
Can you just spell out the implication for those who perhaps haven't fully followed it?
Well, let's take Higgs boson. Everybody knows about Higgs boson. It was predicted as a purely theoretical entity, which has perhaps been confirmed, but there are theorems in physics or postulates which nobody quite knows how to confirm, one of them being superstrings, M theory, and people don't even know how they might go about confirming this, but physicists have said to me quite seriously, if it was beautiful and elegant, we would accept it, even if we didn't know how to confirm it. But other physicists say, no, that's total rubbish. It's not even science anymore. You can't do that. So, you know, people stake their lives, you know, their professional lives on these decisions that they have to make. You know, well, how are they going to devote their research time?
Do you want to come back on that? I mean, the point then being that observational evidence isn't always the thing we use to determine whether something is true. If it's beautiful, if it seems to make sense of the world in a way that any other explanation doesn't, because of its beauty, that may in itself be a reason enough to... It's
enough for us to admire people who commit their lives to the truth of that view, like Einstein.
Did you want to?
Yeah, I mean, I guess a couple of points. I mean, one thing is, yes, I suppose I would align myself with the physicists, of which there are many, who would say, of course, it's interesting and worthwhile to look for beautiful theories as opposed to less beautiful theories. Maybe supersymmetry is an extremely beautiful theory, but now there are reasons to think that it's false. But the point is that if you have theories of that, competing theories of that sort, in the absence of experimental confirmation or disconfirmation, it's just a guess. There are many physicists who think that, and I think that's absolutely right. The second thing I would say is that considerations of beauty are, of course, completely subjective. I would say theories that, you know, for instance, I can understand why Euclidean geometry might be a beautiful theory. Any theistic explanation seems to me to be grotesque.
Let's go to another question. Perhaps we'll take one from nearer the back. There's someone with their hand up in that corner there. Yes.
Hi. Can I ask Dr. Ahmed, have you ever thought that maybe the fact that we don't have evidence for the existence of God is not because there aren't any evidence, but because we as evidence-receiving agents are limited? So what does that possibility play in your consideration?
Is this to Ahmed?
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, of course there's that possibility, but of course that's something for which we could have evidence as well. So for instance, to take an example, take telepathy or ESP. I mean, those are forms of evidence that we don't have. We can't, you know, that sort of experience isn't available to us. But we could have evidence that we were limited in that way, okay? There are experiments which, if they went one way, would have shown that we are limited in our means of gathering evidence, because they would show that some people have ESP or telepathy or other more refined ways of gathering evidence. So it's possible for us to have evidence that we're limited in that way, and of course in some ways we are. We can't see really small things, we can't observe really big things, that's why we develop all kinds of instruments in order to do it, and thus refine our evidence gathering capacities. The point is that even with all that refinement and all of that evidence, we're still no closer to any of the things that, you know, people happen to believe, you know, the myths that people happen to believe 2,000 years ago.
Do you want to add anything to that?
Right. Okay. Is there a question directly for Keith? Maybe we could take one for Keith. And I can see there's a couple of guys just along the side here that might be worth getting to. Maybe as it's coming to you, we'll take you next. And we'll take one. Oh, we're nearly there now. We might as well. Okay.
Directly to Professor Ward, you suggested that your experience of God is a personal experience with a loving God. What is it about your experience of God that coheres with other people's experiences of God, and particularly the philosophers that you admire, that leads you to give it one coherent label rather than just your own personal God?
I didn't quite get that. What is it about... I'm not talking about proof of God, of course, but you claim an experience of God. What makes me think it's authentic?
What about your experience of God coheres with other people's reported experiences of God?
Well, of course, I learned the idea of God from other people, and it's part of the language that I picked up as I grew up. I've read about it in philosophy. So I find that... the view I had, I didn't make it up. I got it from my culture and my reading. Okay, so it's not a question that I have to make my experience cohere with other people's. It's it's a question of whether the language in which they taught me how to view the world made any actual difference to my personal experience. Right, but that's not a question of comfort. It's not comfort. It is a question of what seems most true to your experience. I mean, the nearest example I can think is, how do you see other people? I mean, do you see other people as beings whom you ought to revere and respect and love and care for, or do you see other people as bundles of chemicals? Well, perhaps they're both, but still, those different points of view to me represent the difference between a purely dispassionate evidentialist approach and a more personal, committed approach. Does that make sense?
Do you want to comment on that?
Thanks. Yeah, so a couple of things about that. The first thing is that one thing I thought was insightful in the question was, of course, there is a question. If you're having an experience of something and I'm having an experience of something, why I think we're both experiencing the same thing rather than two different things that are alike in certain ways but different in other ways. And indeed, it's not entirely clear, though there might be some analogies that lead people who are sympathetic to say this, that my experience, or your experiences of God could possibly be experiences of the same thing as a Muslim's or a Hindu's or some other religious person's experiences. The second point just concerned what you said about at the end. I wasn't quite sure how this connected with the answer to the question, to do with the difference between seeing people as bundles of electrons and seeing people as you know, things that are worthy of respect and value and so on. I don't know if this is an implication of what you were saying, but in any case, let me just record the view that there's nothing in empiricism, nothing in the atheist view that implies that we have to think of people only as bundles, walking bundles of electrons and neutrons and so on. Empiricism is entirely compatible with valuing other people as ends in themselves, thinking certain things about other people are valuable, other things are not, treating them with respect, and indeed respecting their life perhaps even more because it's the only one they've got.
Shall we take another question? And perhaps we'll go to the gentleman on the aisle there, and then we'll have someone else. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, this is a question for Professor Ward. When you're discussing William James, you're saying that perhaps there is, perhaps we could have a reason to believe something, because in our finite lives, it might best lead us to live a good life, to believe in God, given there's finite evidence. For the proposition, given that we've only got a finite amount of time to get some evidence. Could you not admit then that it's a possibility that although it might be the best choice to choose to believe in God, it might still be the case that Dr. Ahmed is right, and in fact he doesn't exist, even though it's best to live a life as if you were believing in him, as you were believing in him?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think that's true. I could be wrong. I quite accept it. And of course, there is evidence that might make me wonder whether my belief is, in fact, a coherent one. So that is true. Most people face up to that. Can I just take One more quick analogy is just if you believe that people are free and responsible and should be held guilty for the things that they do that are wrong, normally speaking, I think you're taking an attitude which is not evidentially provable. But I think you ought to commit yourself to it. Okay, so that's another example of something. Should you call criminals in a sound state of mind guilty and punish them? That question is an important question. It's a matter of life or death. And I think there's no evidence either way.
But we commit ourselves to
To the fact that they are free and responsible. Yeah.
Do you want to comment? Yeah,
so I mean, there's various things that have been said, I suppose, in the history of the subject about in response to that kind of question. So one view is the sort of error theory, which is that, in fact, ethical beliefs for that reason are just false, or there's no evidence for them, and we can take certain attitudes towards people, and that's how we conduct our lives. And of course, they're important, and you can value things. All the important things about ethics continue. It's just that we don't think of them as describing part of the furniture of reality in the way that physics does. That seems to me a coherent position that's compatible with caring about and thinking about whether you should punish criminals in one way rather than another. An alternative way to go would be, yes, indeed, to say we do have certain kinds of ethical experiences for which, which gives a sort of evidence for ethical beliefs. So the sort of experiences that people have, let's say in wars or in other very difficult situations, you might develop a certain view where that is genuinely a kind of ethical experience which gives you reasons to believe this, that, or the other view. I don't myself find that especially plausible, but it's something that might be said.
Okay. I just want to push the analogy, not the identity, between moral commitments and beliefs and religious commitments and beliefs and say that's nearer to what religious belief is than looking at science.
It's not, it's very far, because it's as far as can be from the claim that there is a spiritual substance which is the basis of the universe and the source of all values.
It's not, you see, really, because when you believe in God, what you're really believing is that there is one objective, intrinsic, supreme value. The Platonic belief in the good and the true and the beautiful. And you're saying, I believe that exists. I believe that commands my loyalty. I believe I'm not making that up. And you go from there, and you that's near to God. You might not call it God, but if somebody believed that, I'd say that's near to what I call theism.
Right, so are you making a claim about what people value or what people actually believe? Because I thought Christians believe in God.
Well, Christians certainly believe in God, yeah. A Christian might want to say, I'm not just a Platonist, but I think a good Christian, a good philosophically sound Christian, ought to say, well, Plato is the good and the true and the beautiful. That's where we start in religion, not with evidential stuff about how did the universe come about. That's not really the question. I mean, obviously it's an interesting question, but your life-changing question is there an objectively good and beautiful to which
I should... Is there some kind of ultimate meaning, purpose?
Yeah, and there's no evidence for that.
We'll go to another question, and we might start to draw some of this stuff out more. The lady just there next to the microphone, yes.
Thank you very much. I'm fascinated by your drug analogy, but I'd like to probe it maybe a little bit further. So you talk about if you're going to take a drug, you want to make sure that it's been scientifically proven, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, fair enough. So what do? You look at the back of this, or you go to a doctor, et cetera. There are processes and there are trusts involved in that. So even if you go one step further and go, okay, I'm not sure if my doctor's telling me the truth, I'll go and look at all the scientific reports. There you're trusting in a whole number of scientists who've done lots of different experiments. You're trusting on their data to be reliable and repeatable, and for the editor of the journal to have conducted a good peer review. And there are so many different people you actually have to trust in that process. And I don't think it's as simple as kind of science gives us this neat, clean view of the world. And people and experience, that's a little bit more questionable. Also, with the drugs analogy, you were talking about, you yourself admitted that death terrifies you. So, okay, instead think of it as you have a terminal illness, and there are some drugs on offer called these religions. And, okay, none of them are maybe 100% reliable, and different people say different things about them, but you have to evaluate them, and that's the starting point. You're not in a position where you're totally healthy. You have a terminal illness, and you actually have to choose.
Okay, interesting question.
Okay, good. So there's a couple of things to say. I mean, first, the point about trust and drugs. And I guess there's two things you could say about that. But one thing that some people say is that testimony itself is a form of direct knowledge gathering which counts as an independent route to observational evidence. That, I mean, I'm not sure how plausible I find that, but people do think that, because, as you say, otherwise we'd be extremely limited in the sorts of things for which we can have empirical evidence. The second thing is that even if you drop that point, the point is, nonetheless, this sort of thing does count as, given our background beliefs, this sort of thing does count as observational evidence for, you know, for this further judgment, given our background beliefs about the reliability of labs and so on. Given our background beliefs about the reliability of labs, peer review and so on, these other things, there isn't anything that could equivalently count as observational evidence for theistic beliefs.
Does your fear of death in any way count as a observational evidence for anything, or is it purely just a fact that has no relation to the world we live in?
So it's observational evidence that I'm human, I suppose. It's not observational evidence of anything else. But that brings me on to the third point, which is just concerned with, you know, what you would say if somebody offered you certain beliefs in the face of you're going to die very soon. Well, I suppose, again, there's two things about that. I mean, one thing is that there is, of course, an enormous number of possible beliefs that you can have, none of which are consistent with each other. So it wouldn't be a reason to put your belief in any particular one of these things rather than any of the particular other, not just theistic, but magical and other supernatural beliefs like voodoo and Scientology and all of the other ones that you could possibly believe. Exactly the same argument could be run for those beliefs. And the second thing is that the point about the drugs was in part just to do with the fact that this is where we demand more observational evidence. It wasn't to say this is where we change what counts as observational evidence, because the fact is, even when you're on the deathbed, nothing's going to count as observational evidence. So you might demand it, you might be less demanding, but it doesn't mean that there is actually any more evidence for the belief in question.
Just a comment on that, if
you... No, I'm fine. We'll leave that there.
Okay, time for another question. Perhaps we should take another one from the gallery. Well, let's send a microphone towards this man, and while that's going there, we'll take one from perhaps... the chap in the jumper there has had his hand up since the beginning, so let's hear your question.
Thank you. It's a question for Professor Ward. I mean, I accept the arguments you've given tonight, and it's a question that sort of relates to Dr. Armand's point about sort of the plurality of religions, which he touched upon earlier. I mean, you've given arguments to say that, you know, it's not theoretically impossible that God exists, which I think we can accept, and that it adds sort of huge value to people's lives, which, again, I think we can accept, and that you've had a personal psychological experience of Jesus, which, you know, again, we can't deny, because that's your own experience. But it's just the point that if I came in here tonight and made every single same argument and repeated everything you said verbatim, except I replaced the word Jesus with Poseidon, you know, I would genuinely, you know, I'd be laughed out of the room, and people wouldn't take what I was saying particularly in a particularly serious manner. So the question is that I have is, what makes your belief in Jesus and a Christian God different, or do you think it's more legitimate than if I'd have come in here and, as I say, just replace the word Poseidon and said the same arguments?
I certainly would think that if you claimed to have an experience of Poseidon, you would probably be outside the realm of reason. But the reason for that is that Poseidon is not part of our cultural language. It's as simple as that. Poseidon is a dead god. You know, except in imitation religions, people don't believe in Poseidon. There are some new imitation religions, sort of fake primitive religions. But religions have to be practical possibilities for you. They have to be part of your view. And I suppose the trouble is that, people like Araf, you might convince everybody that God is just not in our cultural perspective. It's just not there. It's even, I think you used the word absurd or grotesque. So if that was true, then people who came in and said, I've had an experience of God, would rightly be regarded as just a bit peculiar. So it has to be that's why I insist so much that it has to be within your realm of practical possibilities. Poseidon is not there. Islam is there. Christianity is there. Buddhism is there. There are a number of views, and I personally am very interested in interreligious conversations to see how we can constructively discuss what we think about this. But Poseidon, that you're bringing in something like the spaghetti monster again, because it's just not on the practical possibility thing. And practical possibilities are because they do cohere with well-established scientific thought, or at least we think they do. Until Araf came along, we thought they did. Okay, and so it's still there on the agenda. It may die. Religions do die. But I think there's a reason to ask, why are these religions, the major world religions now, still here after all this time? And why do quite a lot, though not all, perhaps not a majority of scientists and philosophers, still take them seriously? They do. Now, that's a good question. Why do they take them seriously? I think it needs more thought about that than just saying, well, they're just gambling with not enough evidence. And that just doesn't seem the right sort of... Can I say this to Arif, who's an expert on Wittgenstein? It doesn't seem the right sort of language game to play. I mean, you're talking in a different way.
Got a quick response?
Yeah, Harry. So just quickly on the point about my use of the word grotesque, the reason I was using it was in the context of choosing between theories that were beautiful. And on that scale, my own subjective view was that theistic explanations fall very low. That was all I meant by that. Word. I don't think it's absurd. I think it's meaningful. That's why I think it's false. But I don't think it's meaningless. Getting on to the substance of the question, I wasn't quite sure I understood. I mean, there's two things there that you said which I didn't understand. The first thing was what's meant by being part of our cultural language. And if you just mean other people talk about it a lot of the time, that's perfectly true, but that doesn't seem to have any bearing at all on whether the arguments in favour of it are plausible or not. As the questioner said, if you'd replaced it with the word Poseidon, any plausibility your arguments would have been retained in that case. The second point concerns a remark that you made about coherence with scientific beliefs, which I wasn't quite sure I understood. I mean, I don't understand why Poseidon is less coherent with our scientific beliefs than the Christian God.
Oh, that's just not paying any attention to the history of thought at all. I mean, you have to say... People have not seriously discussed whether Poseidon is the cause of the motion of the sea, in my experience. But people do seriously still discuss in conferences on quantum physics, one of which I've just been to, whether God is implicit in things like the collapse of the wave function. Now, lots of arguments about that. I'm not going to go into that. But there are people it's a matter of serious debate and discussion. Some things are. And they're connected with the issue of this hard problem. If you're somebody who puts consciousness as important as you do as an empiricist, you do have a problem. Well, how does consciousness relate to the nature of reality? Is it just a very late arrival on the scene when there wasn't any for all that time? I just think there are serious problems there, which there aren't about Poseidon. That's all. There aren't any serious problems.
I mean, there are no serious conferences where people discuss whether a man could come back to life after being dead for 3 days, for instance. Are you saying there's serious biologists, do you think that might be true?
Well, I'm not talking about biology conferences. Oh, sorry, I'm talking about theology conferences, which are extremely serious.
I thought we were talking about science.
Well, let's go to another question. I did promise the chap up here to... And then we'll probably have time for one more after that. We are running short of time. Are we on?
Question to you both. As a student of St. Paul, it strikes me that there was a fair bit of empiricism in his letters that are the earliest documents in the Christian Bible. Paul reminds his addresses about all the hundreds of Jews whom he says witnessed to seeing the risen Christ. This was so important to Paul, in fact, who claims to have been one of these witnesses himself, that he called Christians the greatest of all fools, were the resurrection to be a lie. Now, how significant or insignificant are these witnesses to your theism or atheism, and why?
Should we start with Keith, maybe?
Because it's my problem. Well, I think, Arif, you probably aren't sympathetic enough to all the discussions about what exactly the resurrection was. but I think it's a complete misunderstanding of it to say, oh, a body just got out of the tomb and walked around and that was it. So you've got to ask about whether it's possible for people to live after death and whether it's possible for people who live after death to appear in human form to other people. And I think the resurrection, on my understanding of it and that of a lot of Christian theologians, like philosophers, theologians don't all agree with each other, was the appearing of Jesus in human form after his death. But it wasn't the body getting up and walking around. So it's not a biological question. It's not a question of biology. And so given that, I think I have to trust, yep, that word trust comes in again, I have to trust the testimony of the disciples who claimed that they had seen Jesus in human form. And I have to decide whether they were liars or deluded, or how to explain that. But the trust is because they are the beginning of a set of institutions, the churches, which have brought me to a particular understanding of God. So it's a very complicated web of thoughts there. But the answer is, yeah, I think it's essential for a Christian to believe the resurrection of Jesus occurred. But let me quote a great Archbishop of Canterbury, Michael Ramsay, who said, well, I'm not quite sure what the resurrection was, but whatever it was, I certainly believe it. That was a joke.
A quick comment. A quick comment on the back of that.
Thanks for the question. Yeah, I completely sympathise with St. Paul's emphasis on experience. But I think you have to ask yourself, what is more likely? It's happened in many times in many places that a number of people have either lied or been mistaken about certain events of religious revelation. Every Christian has to believe that because there are such witnesses to all kinds of miracles in Islam and in other religions. So that's happened many times in all times in all places. It has never been known to happen once at any time in any place, except possibly this one case under discussion, that a man should come back to life in any form after having been dead for 3 days. What's more likely to have happened in this case?
Okay. We are going to take one final question, and I'm going to, if there are any ladies, because I feel we've only had probably one lady contribute. We've got one down here. Great, excellent. Front row, if we could get the microphone down here, and you will have the final question of the evening. Just coming to get it. There we go.
The question is for Arif, or for both of you. I'm thinking of Hilary Putnam trying to collapse a distinction between fact and value and arguing that the scientific conception of truth also assumes certain values such as simplicity or even sort of efficacy in making events occur again, stuff like that. And I would assume that you're going to say, okay, so my question is, what counts as good evidence for you? And I assume that you'll say evidence that works is what counts as good evidence for me. But I would question whether you also sort of have values in evaluating evidence like simplicity, like Occam's razor, that sort of thing. So, for example, you might say, the fact that this ball drops when it falls to the ground is good evidence that there is gravity because it works. But at the same time, that would also be good evidence that there's God that comes and takes his hand and moves the ball to the ground. And the reason that gravity might be a better explanation in that case is because it's a simpler explanation. So what is your thought about simplicity in being a value that we adopt in order to evaluate whether or not evidence is true?
Is that for me?
I think that's for you, good. Arif, and then we'll have...
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question. I would say there are, of course, in many cases, there will be a range of different theories, all of which are more or less equally simple and have other values to more or less the same extent, and are have the same empirical weight. And in that case, it may be a far delicate matter to choose between them. It's just that I don't think any theistic hypothesis is amongst them, because one of the things that you look for a theory is fecundity, and that means things like predicting unexplained observations. We have all kinds of theories which have been spectacularly confirmed because they predicted things that nobody expected. I suppose the perihelion of Mercury is the most well-known example. Well, they predicted things that nobody had been able to explain before in that case. So that's a value which we find in all of these theories, but not in any theory that's theistic, or at least adding the theistic element does nothing to add to that element, or, as far as I can tell, to any other element. So it seems to me that there's no particular reason to add it from that perspective.
Okay, I'll just say my sympathies are entirely with what you said, that I think science is committed to big, deep, important values. What is truth? What is intelligibility? The universe is intelligent. There's a reason for everything. Scientists can find out what it is. Everything is going to follow laws. We'll find them out somehow. Mathematics will work. I think there's a whole lot of faith in there. These are strong value statements. They don't directly get you to God, but I think once you're putting value statements into your evidence, then you say, well, people might have different sets of values on different occasions. So, yeah.
We will leave it there. We could go on all evening. There are many more questions. Perhaps if you're sticking around for the drinks afterwards, you might be able to collar Keith or Arif. For the moment, will you join me in giving them a round of applause?
Well, you've been listening to Unbelievable, a special podcast edition of the programme with me, Justin Brierley, broadcasting the event that took place in Cambridge last week, a discussion between Christian philosopher Keith Ward and atheist philosopher Arif Ahmed. I hope you enjoyed that. And if you've got any comments you'd like to get in touch about it, why not email me? That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget, you can find Unbelievable online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Or indeed, you can Twitter me. That's @UnbelievableJB via Twitter. Or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. I look forward to hearing from you and what you thought of today's show. In the meantime, thank you very much for being with me today. If you want to find out more about the speakers or about the organisation, veritas.org is the place to go. But I'll post full details of the speakers and where you can find out more about them as well with the podcast of today's programme, where you can find more information about the show, past programmes, links to the DVD of Unbelievable, the conference, and so on. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Do hope you can come back at the same time next week. If you're a podcast listener listening online, you're going to be hearing Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, well-known New Testament scholar, who's going to be arguing for his view of justification. It's a huge issue, but somehow we're going to fit it into an hour or so of the show. And he's going to be in conversation with another Christian New Testament scholar who takes a different view. So come back for that. Should be an interesting one. I've long wanted to have Tom Wright on the show. My dreams have finally come true. He's coming in for next week's show. Hope you can join me for that too. Until then, have a great week. I've been Justin Brierley, and I'll see you next time.